Thank you very much for having me here. I've been at Perimeter for almost a week now. It's a wonderful place. It's been really nice to meet all of you. So I'll tell you about a new method of discovering the QCD axion with black holes and gravitational waves. And this is work, hopefully, to be wrapped up soon with Mina and Sinlu, who's also here. So first, I'll give you a brief introduction to remind you about the QCD axion and the current parameter space. And then I'll tell you about the process of superradiance, which lets us detect the axion using black holes. This is a process that extracts energy and angular momentum from spinning curved black holes that are out there in our galaxy and converts it to a giant macroscopic cloud of coherent axion particles. So this leads to two experimental signatures. One is the fact that these black holes spin down. So observations of very rapidly spinning black holes exclude currently open parameter space. And then I'll focus on signatures and signals through gravitational wave detection of axions, where processes that would normally be unobservable, such as annihilations of two axions into a graviton, are now coherently enhanced by huge occupation numbers of these clouds and can be detected in upcoming gravitational wave observatories. Okay. So, in my opinion, the QCD axion is the best motivated particle beyond the standard model, and there's a huge parameter space, a lot of which is still open. The QCD axion solves the strong CP problem by turning the QCD theta angle into a dynamical variable, and it has a specific mass coupling relationship where FA is the decay constant, some high scale where the PQ symmetry is broken, and the mass is fixed by QCD effects which break this U1 symmetry. So for the weaker the coupling is, the lighter the axion mass is. So this is the current PDG limit on axion parameter space. You can see there are two axes. There's the FA, which is the coupling in GeV, and then there's the mass, ranging from KeV down to microEV and below. And most of the limits come from astrophysics, cooling bounds of various objects, and so on, and reach up to 10 to the 9 GeV and FA. And then there's ADMX, which is a current experiment. That's the projected reach right now. It's excluding about a factor of 2 in axion mass. And that one assumes a particular coupling to photons, which is model dependent. There's a hole here, which hopefully Mina and collaborators can fill with a force experiment, but that's a proposed experiment. It's not yet in place. And so these are all the current things that are on the table. But in fact, the parameter space is huge. It can go to much higher FAs, up to the Planck scale, or maybe even higher in the coupling, which would give you masses of nano-EV or pico-EV or smaller. And as you can see, there are no current experiments. There's some other proposed experiments at high FA, but it's very difficult to detect these axions and to produce them in the lab because of their very weak coupling. And in fact, the two experiments that are above 10 to the 12 GeV in FA rely on the axions being dark matter, because then you don't have to produce it. You don't have to pay an extra cost of the very weak production of an axion. So if it's not 100% dark matter, then the only existing limits we have right now go up to 10 to the 9 GeV, and that's all. Yes.
There was a paper a couple of weeks ago on improved, maybe 1 week ago, on curve constraints for 90%
minute. Yes.
So what did that do on
the plot? It didn't do much. It was a factor of 2 in, I think, this part right here. Yeah. There's just a calculation of, I think, the events that would have been seen from the supernova. And it doesn't qualitatively change anything. Okay, so one reason it's hard to detect these very light axions is the very weak coupling, but another reason is that they become macroscopically large. So for FAs of, once you start going above the ADMX range, you have axions that are a meter going off to a kilometer in size, or even longer. So if you're trying to make a resonant experiment in your lab, your experiment won't fit in your lab anymore if you're looking for these axions. Is there something else that you can do, some other detector that can be sensitive to these very long wavelengths of axions? The one I want to tell you about is black holes. Nature has pre-made these great detectors for us. Observationally, they come in two sizes. There's the stellar mass black holes, which are made from collapse of objects slightly heavier than our sun. There's lots of them in our galaxy, possibly a billion black holes in the Milky Way alone. And these correspond in size. They're roughly 15 kilometers, which correspond in size to the QCD axion with coupling constants between the gut scale and the Planck scale, which are theoretically, you might think that it's a good place to break a symmetry. So this is a very well-motivated parameter range. There's also supermassive black holes, which grow by accretion. Presumably, they also started with some collapse event, but they've had a long time to grow to sizes of a million to a billion solar masses. We'll focus on the stellar mass black holes because they're better understood observationally and also are sensitive to a slightly more motivated corner of the parameter space, although the others are starting to be interesting as well. Okay, so I told you that black holes are good because, you know, they're the right size compared to an axion, but okay, this table is the right size compared to some other axion, so why are black holes special? Well, they're special because of a process called superradiance. Let's start first with what the system looks like in general. If you have a particle, such as an axion, that's trapped in orbit around a black hole, the gravitational potential of the black hole is a 1 over r. Once you go a couple of radii away from the horizon, it just looks like a same potential as the hydrogen potential in quantum mechanics that you've all learned about. We have these wave functions, and the axion will take on one of these wave functions based on quantum numbers in its orbit. And then the coupling is characterized by the what we call the fine structure constant of this atom. Instead of e squared over 4 pi, you have the gravitational binding between the black hole and the axion. And it has normal energy levels up to higher order corrections. Yes?
So I assume it's just very small because of the coupling with the axion, but do you know what the decoherence rates of these things in position space are? Like big old wave functions, and there's a bunch of stuff around there, so eventually they'll decoherent.
Yeah, sure. They're very coherent because the couplings are all extremely weak.
Yeah.
So there's no measurement that could localize it in space that has a significant rate. So these are very stable.
So you only need one scattering event for a single axion, and there's bajillions of photons around. That's just still too small.
Yeah, so these are, I mean, we're discussing things that are basically dominantly gravitationally coupled.
Got it.
So, yeah. Right, so we have these orbitals with normal hydrogen wave functions and some of these can be enhanced by the superradiance process. So how does this happen, and what is superradiance? You've learned about the Penrose process, which extracts energy and momentum from a rotating black hole. If you have a rotating black hole, here's the black hole. Around it is an ergosphere. And if a particle passes through the ergosphere, it can extract energy and momentum from the black hole. Now, if you have a particle that continuously travels through this region, it can continue to extract energy and momentum and increase the number of particles in the wave function. When does this happen? Well, in order to be able to get angular momentum, you have to come in with less velocity than you come out. So the angular velocity of the axion has to be less than the angular velocity of the black hole horizon. So here, omega plus can be thought of as the black hole horizon angular velocity, omega is the energy of the particle, and m is the magnetic quantum number, with the where n is the principal quantum number, l is the orbital quantum number, and m is the magnetic quantum number of your familiar hydrogen weight functions. So, and the angular velocity of the black hole depends on the quantity of black hole spin, which we'll call a star in the future slides, so which goes from 0 to 1. And this quantity ranges from 0 for a Schwarzschild black hole to about a half for maximally spinning black holes. And some nomenclature to keep in mind, we'll be talking about the radius of the black hole, which is just the light crossing time. And if you translate this super radiance condition into a limit on the coupling, it turns out that the coupling has to be less than one half of the orbital quantum number. Okay, so which levels satisfy this condition? You can see intuitively that the S levels aren't going to do it because they're localized right on top of the black hole, so they just fall right in. You need some angular momentum to keep the particle orbiting, and the best ones are the high magnetic number levels that are localized in the plane around the black hole. So these are the levels that will become enhanced, and they become enhanced by the super radiance rate. If you start with one particle, the number of particles in that state will grow exponentially with a rate that's a small fraction of the mass, order 10 to the minus 7 to 10 to the minus 14. And as you notice, because this is a quantum mechanical system, you can just have a fluctuation of an axion that will populate this level, and you don't have to have any background density of axions for this process to start. So let's talk a little bit more about the parametrics. Here you see of the super radiance rate. Here you see the coupling, which is, again, the gravitational coupling between the black hole and the axion, going from 0 to 2 in this case, and the corresponding rates in terms of the light crossing time of the black hole. There's a strong dependence on the L level. So these different colors are for L equals 1, 2, 3, and 4. And the higher L levels are localized further from the black hole, so they're less effective at extracting energy from the black hole. Also, it's a steep function of the coupling because the axion cloud is localized at a certain radius. And for weaker couplings, the overlap of the size of the axion with the black hole becomes smaller and smaller. And it drops off as a power law, so it's important that it's not a resonance condition, it's a kinematic condition. You can, given an axion mass, you have a factor of a few in black hole mass that can still lead to a significant rate. There's also the super radiance boundary, which is what causes these curves to turn over at larger couplings. So depending on the spin of the black hole, the super radiance boundary is higher or lower. For maximal spins, this number is a half. And then as you drop the spin, 2.99, which are the solid lines, or 0.9, which are the dashed lines, the boundary comes in earlier and earlier. So you need a quickly spinning black hole for this effect to be sizable. And to put it in terms of physical timescales, if you have an axion of order 10 to the minus 11 eV, for a 10 solar mass black hole, these rates are between 100 seconds and 100 years. So it's a huge range of parameter space, but one important thing is that these are all very quick on astrophysical timescales. For example, the time it takes a black hole to accrete an order one amount of mass is 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 9 years. So these are these are the super radiance rates. So the time it takes for a cloud to increase by an order one fraction. And these are for different L levels. Okay. So this is the SP, FG, hydrogen wave functions, whichever, D, P, D, F, G. Yeah. So P, D, F, G. Thank you. yes. won't be attested then.
Yeah. I just got myself lost. I apologize.
Yes.
So the axions are, when you say the super radiance rate, what does that mean? Every 100 seconds it's doing what exactly?
Yes. So you start with one axion, and then every 100 seconds the amount of axions in the wave function increases by a factor
just
of
like
p.
In that orbital, just,
yes.
Just increasing. Okay.
Exactly.
And what's the limit on that?
That's a great question. So the limit is when you extract, as the cloud grows, the spin of the black hole decreases. And at some point, the spin of the black hole will be so small that the super radiance condition is no longer valid. The black hole is spinning too slowly. And at that point, the process stops.
So are 100 seconds obviously ruled out? Because then we would never see any spinning black holes?
Exactly. So I'll get there very shortly.
Got it.
Yeah, that's a great question.
What's the dotted line again?
So the two lines are for different spins. So this is for a very quickly spinning black hole, 0.99, and this is for 0.9. And to give you a sense, yes? Oh, okay. Yeah. So for faster spinning the black holes, there's a wider range of parameter space that's available, and also the rate is higher. Okay. So this is exactly what Jess was talking about. If you fix an axion mass, the spins and masses of black holes that are affected by super radiance are these shaded regions here. So here are the L equals 1, 2, 3, 4 levels. And this is for an axion mass of 10 to the minus 11 eV. And the shape of these curves, so again, on the right, they're cut off by the super radiance boundary. The black hole is spinning too slowly for the effect to be effective. And then the reason the curves turn up is because I've fixed that the spin gets extracted quickly enough in an astrophysical amount of time. So here you want to extract order one of the spin of the black hole in 10 to the 6 years, which is the time of a binary black hole with a heavy star around it. So let's say you start with a...
So it
depends on the system. So the accretion time is 10 to the 8 years. For example, if you have a black hole with a heavy companion, the companion will have exploded in 10 to the 6 years, roughly. So if we observe such a system, that means the black hole is younger than 10 to the 6 years.
So it's a lifetime.
Yeah, exactly.
So can I think about this as kind of a friction for black hole spinning that's like has a strong velocity dependence in the sense that because as the black hole spins down, the rate of super radiance can drop off very fast, right? So if it starts to get spin up, then it'll start super radiating and it'll extract down. It'll bring it down until that process.
Yes, until the process stops.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So here, let's follow the trajectory of a black hole. So you're anticipating all my slides. No, it's good. So we start with a black hole with high spin of, say, 0.95, which is very reasonable considering if you form a black hole in some stellar collapse, you have to eject a ton of angular momentum to collapse down to the small size. So it's very likely that natal spins of black holes are high. Then you and some reasonable mass, 6 solar masses. Then what happens to the black hole? After the cloud of axions starts to grow. After about 200 super radiance times, the size of the cloud is huge. It's about 10 to the 77 axions in the cloud. And the amount of time this takes is 200 super radiance times, which is about 2 years for these parameters. then the black hole lands on this edge of the super radiance curve, and the process shuts off. There's a next level that can start to be populated, but here, now you have a huge cloud of axions sitting there. And this is a bit model dependent, but for the QCD axion, there's an interaction which sources another potential that's no longer axially symmetric. And if you start populating the L equals 3 level, it'll actually mix with some other levels that are falling back into the black hole. So the process is not efficient. So the black hole has to sit and wait there until most of a large fraction of the cloud annihilates away so that this process is no longer so that the growth of the next level is no longer being impeded by the presence of the L equals 2 level. So for these parameters, it takes about 1 million years for the black hole to continue growing the next level.
Is there an easy way to see why the potential that it sources impedes the growth?
Why the potential that it sources impedes the growth?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you have, so right now we're assuming that the or the black hole sources a perfectly symmetrical one over r potential, and then you introduce some perturbation to that potential. So now if you have some wave function that's starting to grow, there will be a mixing term between, say, L equals 3, M equals 3, and L equals 3, M equals minus 3. And it turns out that some of the M equals minus 3 mode is counter-rotating to the black hole, and it actually falls in instead of being extracted. So if you mix in a level that's trying to grow with a level that's trying to fall in, then the super radiance doesn't work.
Yes. These axions decay?
The axions don't
decay.
So,
like,
they're very light.
Two photons,
yeah, those processes are longer than the age of the universe, yeah. Okay.
But is there nothing significant? I mean, given that there's 10 to the 77 of them, is that you still not an interesting thing?
I haven't thought about the numbers, but I think the rates would be too small because FA is very, very high here. And also the environments of black hole, I mean, the environments of black holes are very messy and these frequencies are fairly low, so I'm not sure what, if there's a telescope that would be sensitive to this, and also the background is huge. So as far as I know, it doesn't work, but worth double checking again.
It's much smaller compared to the Lucifer-Alliance rate.
Okay. Okay, so then finally, when the axion level gets depleted, the black hole makes another jump in the spin. Now it loses an order one fraction of its spin, but it takes much longer because the spin is lower, and also the L equals 3 level has a lower super radiance rate, if you remember from the previous slide. And here the black hole just gets stuck because there's no more parameter space where super radiance is relevant. So if you start with a black hole of spin 0.95, then in about a million years, it ends up down at the bottom here at spin of below 0.6. Okay. So any questions on the history of super radiance?
Can you repeat the time scales? So
yes.
You go from the 0.99 point.
Yeah, so here, you start here, you go down in about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Then if it's the QCD axion, you get stuck there for about a million years.
Mm-hmm.
But as you go up this curve, that time becomes much shorter. So. And then for the next jump, it takes about 10 to the 5 years.
And
the difference is in the difference of the spins. Here it's higher, so the rate is faster, and also the higher L levels, which are further away from the black hole, are much slower at extracting the spin. Yes.
And these time scales, I guess, are important. If you try to estimate how many black holes are super radiating axions, these time scales are important.
You mean for events?
In the universe.
Yeah.
Why are you calling these wedge
interactors? Well, this is a fixed relationship between the mass and the spin of the particle.
Like,
yeah, this is a historical name. They're curves in that spin where they stay for a long time.
Yeah, it's very
dominant. In terms of the amount of time you spend there, you dominantly do live there. Yes. Yeah.
So Masha, this is for the first transition, you have an active black hole for 2 years.
An active black hole.
And then you have gravitational waves.
No. So these are just the super radiance time. So I haven't gotten to the signals yet.
Okay.
Yes.
Does this work for neutron stars?
Well, neutron stars are much lighter, and also the very important thing is that black holes are perfectly spherically symmetric, so you don't introduce this mode mixing that I mentioned. So the coupling is, and they're rotating slower. So basically, black holes are just much better than neutron stars in all the different parameters you can pick. You might get some tiny effect.
I have no idea.
It's order one.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So to summarize, black holes are great for exploring this range of axions. They're just the right size. and it does not rely on, something I want to mention is it doesn't actually rely on it being the QCD axion if you have another favorite particle that is similar mass and coupling and is a boson, this process will take place. But I'll keep focusing on QCD axions because that's what we're most interested in looking for. It doesn't rely on it being a dark matter, and it's a kinematic condition, so you can be sensitive for, if you have a axion here, there's a range of black holes that will undergo superradiance in the presence of that axion. Yes?
So why is there such a distinct classification of black holes?
That's a great question. Maybe it's a better question for astrophysicists, but observationally, these guys and those guys are easier to see. That's one reason, so I'm just being very conservative and only saying the ones that we know are out there. Also, these, you know, eventually these guys are formed by accretion of these guys, so it depends. There may be some stuff in here, but we don't know any of their properties. Yeah, it's a great question. Okay. So now let's talk about the experimental limits. And black hole spins here again is the parameter space for the 10 to minus 11 EV axion. And these are the measured current experimental measurements. So these are actual data points. There are two current techniques that are used to measure black hole spins. And it's a relatively young field, so these are rapidly improving. And there are many more spins that are being measured. So you can see that there are at least two very quickly rotating black holes that that would exclude this axion mass.
One point
yes.
is just one black hole?
One point, each point is one black hole, yes. So the error bars are on the mass here and the spin at one sigma. Yes?
Would you say they were like 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9?
Yes, these are observed. Yes. Potentially we could measure 10 to the 9 black hole spins, which would be awesome. Yes?
We measure 10,000 black holes and you see a nice curve on this plot. In fact,
yes.
It even has ridges.
Yes. So it would be awesome, yes, it would be great if you got your sensitivity down far enough that these error bars would distinguish the black holes that land on this Ricci trajectory here. This would probably not be the case for the QCD axion because the coupling is a bit too weak for them to stay there for a very long time, but that would be really cool. Yes. Okay.
Sorry,
yes.
Just because I know the this A star and the L parameter.
Yeah, A star
what,
and
yeah,
the L parameter.
I'm just wondering what two sigma actually means here. Like, what the error bars, what the, how far is it going?
Oh.
What's the likelihood?
Yeah, I mean, for stellar black holes, it's relatively Gaussian. Yes, that's it.
Really?
Yeah.
So why is what they're measuring?
Sorry. That's for the mass. What they're measuring is what's called this radius, inner stable
yes.
orbit
okay. yeah.
radius, and that's the observational signature, is the closest orbit of the accretion disk before all the stuff starts falling directly into the black hole. And that's a particular analytic function of the black hole spin. So you can tell from here that the error bars actually get smaller at high spins because this function is sharper at higher spins. But you
okay,
can,
but I mean, that's if you plotted an A star. If you plotted an L, it's still getting smaller.
What do you call L?
There was some other angular momentum parameter.
The omega plus?
Yeah, oh, omega plus.
Yeah. no, it's all good. If you plot it in omega plus, is it still Gaussian? Well, it's not particularly Gaussian in A star. I'm just taking
sure.
the
I mean,
quartered limits.
Omega plus is still getting smaller at high spins.
I'm not actually. Yes, probably. Yes. I'd have to think about that. But the relevant, I mean, the omega plus is not an intermediate between the measurement and A star. You just
right, but it is the thing that's most linearly related.
Yeah, it's a good question. I need to think about that a bit more.
The
omega plus is slightly different. A star is the dimension of quantum quantified in space. Omega plus has also, you need to know the size of the black hole.
Yeah.
So.
But you need to know the size of the black hole for this too.
There's a nonlinearity involved. So you can define an appropriately whatever.
Yeah,
size
sort of a yes.
But it's that nonlinearity that I'm wondering about. How that nonlinearity of omega plus is a function. Yeah. When you map the full likelihood onto omega plus, how confident are you really that you're excluding this axiom?
But the thing is, we're excluding it as a function of just A star. There's no omega plus
okay,
that
so
really
you
enters.
You have like a likelihood of the papers for what
yes.
the two sigma error bars are. They're entirely continuous.
Yes. So in fact, the error bars on these two high guys are, I think, at 3 sigma above 0.95. So it's very likely that they're very quickly rotating. Okay, so if you shift the axion mass to lighter masses, then even more black holes exclude this region. So they there's a stronger constraint. So let's see what this looks like in the parameter space. Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
Oh yeah, that long guy disappeared. I apologize. Okay. All right. So here, so let's take this Cygnus X1 guy and see what the limits from him are. So it excludes an order of mass. So this is a mass and coupling plane. We've been focusing on the QCD axion, which is this line here. But you could generalize it to different particles. And here's a for reference, if you're looking for light scalars, for example, for the quartic coupling, these are relevant numbers. Lambdas of roughly 10 to minus 70. So here the masses are excluded here. And then as the coupling becomes stronger, super radiance is less effective. The reason is that now the cloud has a self-interaction that's attractive. And the cloud can actually collapse under its own self-interactions before it gets a chance to grow to the maximal size. So the limits get weaker as you go to stronger coupling. And these are the limits from each level. Then there's a, I'm not sure if you can see the outline, but there's a hole here where it would have been excluded, except that the time spent for these parameters on the Reggie trajectory is long enough that we can't place an exclusion. It could be that the black hole is just stuck along one of these lines. Yeah.
So are there other processes that can change the black hole spin? Then, if you add that effect, that may strengthen or.
There are other processes that change the black hole spin. But I was briefly mentioning that things like accretion, for example, or you can have violent events like mergers. Accretion is extremely slow, and that's what I take into account here, where I say that superradiance has to be fast enough that that's the dominant process. For things like mergers, they're extremely rare. So in our galaxy, one black hole might merge with another black hole maybe 10 to the minus 4 times every 100 years. Okay, that's out of all the billion black holes. So given one black hole, the chance for something to merge during that time is basically zero. So if we combine all the limits here, from these five black holes that are all the fastest rotating, best measured black holes, they overlap on top of each other a bit. Each outline is a different black hole, so these are the five, and it excludes this parameter space for FAs from roughly Planck down to 4 times 10 to the 17 GeV. And just to briefly mention, there are also spin measurements of supermassive black holes. These are slightly less robust because they're newer. There is only one method for measuring these, but already they're setting some preliminary limits on parameter space around axions of 10 to the minus 17 to 10 to minus 16 eV. All right. So here, placing these limits on the parameter space, we see that black holes are already starting to probe previously inaccessible axion masses, and we've excluded an order of magnitude in mass from these five black hole measurements. Okay, any questions on spin measurements?
I just have a question on the curiosity.
Yeah.
How recent are these black hole measurements?
So they've been, the techniques were developed a few decades ago, but they've been started to pick up in the last 10 years. So since Mina wrote her first paper on this topic like 5 years ago, there have been maybe half a dozen more measurements.
It's very impressive that you can constrain that.
Yeah.
And I was wondering why wasn't this done 30 years ago?
Yes.
So this is my question. Well, 30 years ago, even superradiance.
Well, people knew about super radiance 30 years ago, but they thought, oh, you could do super radiance with pions.
Yes,
and
exactly.
And really, really small black holes, which
but
is not really very interesting.
And actually,
wouldn't be really cute.
It doesn't even happen for pions, because pions are too strongly interactive.
Right.
The point is that you have to compare the gravitational interaction strength with whatever interaction strength. And actions are very good because the quantity is only too small.
Yeah, and the measurements are relatively recent too. So this is definitely an emerging field, and there will be lots more measurements soon. Yeah.
Does this work for a light particle that has no interactions besides gravitational waves?
Yes. So all we care about is that the interaction is weak enough and that the mass is in the right range. And it's a boson. Okay, so now on to the very exciting prospects of actually detecting these particles, not just setting limits. We have these giant clouds of axions surrounding astrophysical black holes in our galaxy, and we want to see if we can detect any signals coming out of those clouds. So the new detectors, Advanced LIGO and Virgo, are coming online next year, and they'll be improving their sensitivity over the next 4 or 5 years. And they can be sensitive to three kinds of effects. There's transitions of axions between levels. If you have two levels of this hydrogen atom that are simultaneously populated, axion can drop down and emit a graviton. There's also two axions that can annihilate into one graviton in the background of the black hole. And then there's the boson nova, which I probably won't have time to talk about, but in case anyone is interested, I can mention it at the end, which is if you have self-interactions, as the cloud grows to a certain size under those interactions will collapse and emit a burst of gravitational waves. Okay, so transitions are, again, if you have an excited state and a ground state and you emit a graviton, and the gravitational strain from one such event is completely negligible, these rates are much slower than the super radiance rates. But once you grow to large sizes of the ground and excited state population number, they're coherently enhanced, and the gravitational strain, which is notated by the letter H in the LIGO literature, is can become observable. So this is a time evolution of the levels. So you can see the blue and the orange level are the ground and the excited states. On the y-axis is the number, and on this side is the strain. It's the black is the strain, and as a function of time, we picked time equals zero when the event first starts. So there's one axion in each level, and then they grow together. So here, at the beginning, both the levels are growing with their super radiance rates. And then eventually, when the number gets large enough to 10 to the 60, 10 to the 65, the transition term becomes important. And here you see that the ground state catches up to the excited state, and then the excited state quickly depopulates down as the axions all at once transition to the ground state. And that's the peak of the signal. And you can see that these are very long times. These are thousands of years. So the signal itself will be, the peak of the signal is ordered 10 to 100 years. So compared to, you know, when I talk about events that we will see at LIGO. This is not, you know, a particle collision at the LHC. It's a continuous long event that will last longer than the LIGO experimental run, and you can study it in more detail and see if you can get any more information out of it.
So for 100 years, you get monochromatic radiation.
Yes.
It's a dream.
Yes. So exactly. So
it's
this.
Yeah.
So the signal is very monochromatic. You have two axions and energy eigenstates of the atom, and they transition to one graviton. And there's a small frequency drift if there's a QCD axion coupling, which is of order 10 to the minus 11 hertz per second. So that's small enough so that they can still use the monochromatic search, which is already exists for some other parameters at LIGO. But it might be big enough so that if you do see the signal, you can study it and pinpoint what the coupling of the axion is and confirm that it's actually the QCD axion. So this scales as this frequency drift is larger for stronger couplings because it comes from the self-interactions of the cloud itself.
Is there a way to associate this with a particular black hole?
Well, once you have, so there are two LIGO detectors, and then there's another Virgo detector, and maybe they'll build another one eventually in India. So once you have a network, you can localize it in position space. I'm not sure exactly how you'd correlate with that with other observations. If the black hole doesn't have an accretion disk around it, for example, this would be the only way to see that it's there.
But gives you the direction, would the strength give you the distance?
The strength, well, it's degenerate with some other parameters. But you could triangulate the position using several LIGO detectors.
Would just the width of the Earth, would it be enough to give you a distance through?
I'm not sure.
Or of the earthquake?
Basically, I mean, there's also a polarization of the wave that's coming in. So as the Earth rotates, you can tell what direction it's coming from. That's more for the LIGO experts. But they say that you can localize things in space pretty well once you get enough sensitivity. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Just have to hope it's there.
Yes, exactly. So let's see. Yeah, let's see.
Can you go back? Yes. So this 100 years was for F of Hamgard or something?
Well, the 100 years is basically for signals that you can see. And the weaker the signal is, generally, the longer it is. Mm-hmm. So the 100 years is if you have a quickly enough spinning black hole at the center of our galaxy. It's a typical time scale, but it can range from 10 to 10 to the 4 or 5 years. Yeah. So just to give you a sense, this is what LIGO sensitivities are. So right now, they're going to start a little bit higher than the design sensitivity and slowly work down up to the year 2019. We'll be estimating the reach with the design sensitivity, which should be in a few years. But it actually scales, the reach scales linearly with the sensitivity. So we'll see, you might even be able to see events earlier than when they reach their design sensitivity.
What's PNS?
BNS, oh yeah, sorry. That's the thing that they really like looking for is black hole, neutron star, and spiral.
They just want to get on the frequency range?
Yeah, so this is interesting because they can change some parameters of the detector to focus on certain frequency ranges. So maybe if they get excited enough about axion detection, they could also improve the frequencies that are better for us.
Is the thing on the right-hand side the same that was on your axion plot, the H, or is it
the
something
H.
else?
Yeah, so yes, so this is the strain noise. So this is the noise per root hertz. Whereas the other one was,
sorry,
yeah. So this is, yes, this is the noise. And the other one is just the strain. So if you integrate an event for a second, then this would be the sensitivity. If you integrate the event for longer, then the sensitivity goes down as the square root of your integration time, as long as the signal is coherent, which is why it's really great that our signal is very coherent, because you can bring down this noise floor further. Okay, so let's see.
Can
what.
You go back?
Yes. Here?
So on the left, you said, these are back I mean, these are things you worry about, mountains and neutrons.
Oh, yes, these are things that they already look for. Just to give you a sense of possible signals that they find interesting. So there's in spirals of black holes with black holes and black holes with neutron stars, and those they have expect to see between 0.1 and maybe 100 events. So there's a large uncertainty about how many events you could see. Then they look for the mountains on neutron stars.
In a year or 0.1? Or the lifetime of advanced LIGO?
Yeah, they're roughly the same. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Mountains are not their best. Their best signal.
Yes, mountains are not their best signal, as you'll see when I compare it to, as you'll see when I compare it to Earth signal. The mountains are useful because it's already an existing search where they look for monochromatic
exactly.
radiation. So that's what we're kind of using as a guideline to what their sensitivity would be. Yeah. Thanks. Okay. So this would be the reach. If there's an axion here on the x-axis, if there's an axion at some mass. The reach in kiloparsecs to the perfect signal. So you have a black hole that's just the right size for that axion. It has a high spin. Either this dashed curve is 0.9 or very high 0.99. And you have the right size, and it's currently undergoing the transition signal. Okay, so this is, if you don't think in kiloparsecs, which I didn't, you know, a year ago, you have, here is 8 kiloparsecs is the distance to the galactic center. So you can definitely see our galaxy. As you go further, there's the local group at 2 megaparsecs and the Virgo supercluster, which has many more Milky Way type galaxies that you can maybe reach with the highest spinning black holes. So this is very promising. Heavier black holes have more axions around them, and so they have bigger signals. But as you go to lower frequencies, it gets cut off by the LIGO noise floor at 10 hertz. Okay. So just to compare this with the mountains search, this is, to be fair, this is current LIGO, where this would be advanced LIGO. But their reach is between 1 and 4 kiloparsecs. So it's like somewhere down here.
So
yes?
Do you have a sort of order of magnitude estimate of what the current LIGO sensitivity
would be? So it would be down by a factor of 10. Okay.
10 in radius or 10 in distance or 10
in
distance? Distance.
Distance.
H
in
H. H goes as the distance.
Like
yeah.
Okay, so that was the reach, but how many, I think this was Savas's question earlier, how likely is it that you can actually see this event? And since the events are very long, that's great because you're more likely to see something that lasts hundreds of years. But unfortunately, you're probably only going to see these events once in the lifetime of the black hole because the levels need to be comparable in size for the transition rate to be big enough. Excuse me. So how often is a black hole formed in the Milky Way? Well, it's roughly once every 100 to 1,000 years. This we get out of estimates for supernova rates. And also, you know, there's 10 to the 9 black holes, and the galaxy is 10 billion years old. So roughly, this is the correct order of magnitude. And the signal, for some typical parameters, like I said, the signal lasts for about 20 years. For reasonably high spin of 0.9, 8 kiloparsec is the distance to the galactic center, and a 10 solar mass black hole. So then this factor would be 1/5, but then we have to take into account some distribution for the spin and distribution for the black hole masses. If we integrate over those distributions, we get a probability to see an event at LIGO, which can even reach 1. It's really exciting for gravitational wave detection. If you have an axion between 1 and 5, 10 times 10 to minus 11 eV in mass, then you get a chance to see this very long coherent signal. The width, so on the y-axis is the number of events, which can be roughly interpreted as the probability to see an event. The width of the band is mostly determined by astrophysical uncertainties like spin, how many quickly spinning black holes there are, what's the black hole formation rate. It's less sensitive to the mass distributions of black holes. So here are the three different bands. I've picked three different kind of empirically measured mass distributions of black holes. So it shifts the curve around a little bit, but the overall event rate doesn't change. If you, the right edge gets cut off by the minimum possible mass of a black hole that's formed, that can be formed. Here I'm using 4, which is one favorite from our astrophysics friends, but we hear that that doesn't have to be the minimum, so you can possibly push this lower, which would move this curve over to the right and be sensitive to heavier axion masses. Okay, any questions on transitions? Great. So let's move on to annihilations. These signals are...
sorry, one quick question.
Yes.
Remind me what the mass range was that was constrained by that you excluded this.
Oh, yes, thank you. That's,
it doesn't show up.
Okay, I have it on my computer, but it's roughly here.
Oh, I see.
So this is peeking out right above there. Yes, it is, yes. So yes, that's why it says complementary to spin limits. Yes, thank you. I didn't realize it wasn't showing up. Okay. So annihilations is...
Sorry,
yes.
So is there a way to distinguish this from the mountain?
Yes, so, well, for one, it's slightly different frequency range. This tends to be at lower frequencies. And then there's also, again, the time dependence. So if neutron stars obviously spin down as they lose energy through gravitational waves, for both annihilations and transitions, you can get the behavior where the frequency increases as time goes on, which would be a really cool signal to see in astrophysics because something is increasing in energy as time goes on. And the drift in frequency is usually much slower than for neutron stars. Yeah. So for annihilations, the signal length can be even longer.
Can you go back?
Yes.
So did you mention what is the expected thing in advanced LIGO?
The expected
black hole events that they're expecting to see.
The black hole events that they're expecting to see. Yeah. So, well, they have
nothing in your theory. I mean,
yeah. So here we have a kind of a lower, reasonable and optimistic estimate of what the events would be. So they have something similar, and the lower range is order 0.1 to half an event, and it can go up to tens to hundreds of events. So they have slightly different uncertainties because they need black holes to be two black holes next to each other, right? Where we just need one isolated black hole with a high spin. So the uncertainties are roughly a factor of 1,000 or even 10 to the 4. So this is definitely, you know, comparable to the event rates that they're looking for already. So for annihilations, the strain, so it's just, you just need one level, unlike transitions. So it's, and can last much longer. Here we show the number of the strain from annihilations of one level in an axion cloud. You start populating the level for two different black holes. So you have a small black hole and a slightly heavier black hole. This one grows faster to its maximal size before it extracts all the black hole spins. Then the extraction stops. You have a large cloud, and annihilations start to slowly deplete the number of axions in the cloud. And the annihilation rate is proportional to just the number of axions. The same thing happens for the heavier black hole. The peak is reached slightly later, and the process takes longer. So the annihilation rate is even slower than the transition rate, so these events can last for thousands of years. So if you run a LIGO detector now and you run another LIGO detector in 1,000 years, you would be able to see the same event. Probably not you personally, but somebody. Okay, so what's the, and there's also a similar frequency drift. It's slightly slower because the process is slower, but it still may be observable over long times. Okay, so this is the reach for different.
I'm confused about one thing. You said that you cannot see photons, but you can see annihilations.
Yeah, so annihilations are two axions
right.
annihilating through the gravitational coupling
right.
to a graviton in the background of a black hole.
Right.
Whereas
the rate is still not huge.
The rate is not the rate for
the
for
rate
gravitons?
Yeah. I'm just trying to compare the decay to two photons.
Well, the decay to two photons is a different process, right? Because
yeah,
you're suppressed by the tiny axion mass to a high power.
Oh, okay.
So here you have the reach for different. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Question? No. Okay. The
maybe
reach.
This is naive, but why do you expect phase coherence over this whole time?
Phase coherence of the signal.
Of the signal. Yeah.
Well, there's a. From the point of view of the black hole, there's a just a cloud that's basically one giant axion condensate that's emitting at the same frequency. So there's phase coherence there, and then when we observe it from Earth, there's some Doppler shift and some relative motion, but that's something that you know the LIGO search takes into account because it's similar to what they look for. I guess the question would be why?
Because all the axions are coherent, but all
yes.
the annihilation products
exactly.
are
yes, yes. So it's like one giant wave function emitting one giant.
And there's nothing local, like around the black hole that could somehow change.
Yeah.
There can be things around the black hole which would cause some level mixing, for example, if you have a orbiting star that could induce some mixing between the level you're interested in and some other one, but that just changes the overall energy of the level and it changes adiabatic. So at each point in time, you have eigenstate of the full potential of the black hole plus any crap
right.
that's around
that,
it.
That would affect the phase coherence, or your ability to model it as coherent plus things you can calculate, like that one.
Yeah, so first of all, a little bit of
yes.
no, but about the time scale, just the time, okay.
The time scale for the signal, so any perturbation, first of all, is adiabatic because the energy scale of the axion is much higher than the frequency of any orbiting object around the black hole. And so at each point, you just coherently change the energy to possibly a slightly different value. But I don't see why that would be used.
How long period compared to the duration of observation?
They can be shorted.
Can I clarify something really quickly? So first of all, you want to be coherent over 25 hours because this is the you don't want. To
yeah, yeah. Sorry. Oh, sorry.
Yeah,
yes.
This is what
sorry. So here we're assuming. Yeah, we're not assuming that we're coherently integrating for 1,000
yeah.
years. Yeah. Thank you. Where
yeah.
the integration
right.
period for this search
is
25 hours.
Too
yes.
<That's
correct>. Okay.
First, I was interested in 1,000.
Yeah. Okay, so,
yeah,
yes. Thank you, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so let me quickly finish up with annihilations. So here's the reach. It's comparable to what you saw for transitions. It's a bit worse because the signal is weaker, and it's mostly at lighter axion masses. So maybe you can see these two lines here. This is the excluded regions from spins. So mostly you might be sensitive a little bit here, but the reach is less than the galactic center, and then most of your reach would come from lighter axions that are above the exclusion. So these are the event rates. You can see that these are even more promising. They can be over 1 up to 100, even 100 events at these axion masses. Here, the uncertainty mostly comes from black hole mass distributions. So the width of the curve vertically is still from how many quickly spinning black holes there are and how often they're born. But the shape here depends on kind of the tail of heavy black holes that there are of 50 to 100 solar masses. And as I mentioned at the beginning, people don't really know how many black holes there would be. Here we take a, you know, relatively conservative exponentially decaying probability to find a heavy black hole. And you can see that the expectation value is around 1 for an event, and it can be quite high. Okay?
It's pretty awesome.
Yes. Thousands little annihilation events going.
Yeah.
Yes?
It didn't show up, but the exclusion curve is right at what the first.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, well, oh, the, again, yeah, saying we're. Sinlu the pessimist is reminding me that this is already excluded. But this band.
We can make the great diagram.
Yeah. It doesn't show up on the projector. It shows up fine on the screen. But these are the lines that are excluded by spin measurements. Okay. So here's the part that you would actually be able to see.
Unless you have the dashboard.
Yes, unless for some reason, unless black holes stop at 40 solar masses, then there are no heavier black holes than 40 solar masses. Yes, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, this is just the chopping it off for some arbitrary reason of how stars collapse. Yes. Okay. So I'm going to skip the Bosanova, but there can be interesting burst events too, and these should be modeled in more detail numerically to really understand what the signal looks like. There's also super exciting future gravitational detector signatures, especially for annihilations. You can get millions of events. Here's the band if you can't see it. This is assuming something like a space-based detector like LISA or AEGIS. But that's still far in the future, so I'm not going to focus on it. But
that's
also very old, super fine. So, yeah, and these are also, so the x-axis here goes from 10 to the minus 16 to 10 to minus 19 eV. So these are trans-Planckian Fs, or not the QCD axion, but a lighter axion for the same coupling. Okay. So these are some rates, which we've already seen, that you can see between a fraction and the chance to see an event is between a few percent and 1 for transitions, and you could see several events or as many as tens of events for annihilations, and then you see huge numbers of events if you have a very light particle at future detectors. Okay, to conclude, black holes are really great systems for looking for ultralight particles, including the QCD axion. And there are already new spin limits, which in blue there, which exclude previously unsearchable parameter space. And there's also some orange at the top for very light particles. And then you have two signals. There's the signals from gut scale axions in green, right below the exclusion limits, which you could see from transitions. And then there's the annihilations of sort of Planck scale FA axions in purple. Both of which you could see with advanced LIGO, which is turning on next year. So, thank you. Yeah.
So one could criticize that there's not much point in doing a bunch of detailed calculations. You should just wait for LIGO to turn on, and then just understand everything you get out of that. But you could reply to that by saying, well, actually, we want to influence how they run LIGO, like in order to search for something, right? So what kind of suggestions or requests of LIGO or a future gravitational wave detector would you make in order to?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, so there's two aspects to your question. First, there is doing our analysis more precisely. So our estimates are accurate to, I'd say, order 10% in the energies and maybe order 1 in the rates. But if you do a more careful numerical study of how the cloud forms and how the transitions and annihilations happen, that could influence some of the expectation by, you know, tens of percent maybe. And then also we want to make sure that the LIGO people would actually do the search. So the difference would be a current search that they're doing is monochromatic search for these neutron stars. That are spinning down at a certain rate, and they're in a certain frequency band. So the easiest thing would be just to expand their reach and frequencies to slightly lower frequencies, and also make sure that they're looking for these less expected frequency drifts, like where the frequency can drift up. So that's just from a numerical analysis point of view. They already have the data.
Yeah.
And then it would be more difficult to ask for them to optimize their detector to look at low frequencies because they're already trying to do that, but that would be the next best thing to do. Does that answer your question? Or?
Yeah. So and this is kind of a related question. So the LHC is a very complicated experiment. It's kind of, it doesn't seem reasonable, or doesn't seem plausible to, say, publicly release the data because there's just so much going on. You have so much familiarity with the ins and outs of the detector in order to use that data usefully.
Yeah, do you want to analyze the LIGO data for it?
Yeah. Well, is LIGO data like that? Or is it
I don't actually know the detail. I mean, of course, it's slightly more simple because it's just a kind of a time function of the strain.
Right.
But for example, for the analysis that they do for the neutron stars, there's a very complicated way to analyze the data where they actually use the Einstein at home kind of mini computer setup to do these huge computations. The problem is that if you have a monochromatic source here and you have the Earth here and the monochromatic source is orbiting with respect to us, you have to take into account possible frequency shifts and integrate over all possibilities in order to tease out the signal. So I don't know if you just wouldn't have the computational power to do that yourself.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm not talking about me.
No, but you could. Yeah, I don't actually know. Does anyone know if they released their data publicly?
I don't think they have.
I don't think they have to, so probably they don't. That's the general assumption.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So does that mean they're making assumptions about how far it is there, or is it just from the Earth's motion?
Partially from the Earth's motion. I mean, there's some galactic motion relative to the center. Yeah.
So, okay, maybe I can make some. This is really cool, but you can tell me if some pessimistic comments are wrong too.
Okay.
So the first is that I guess for the sort of high end of the gut scale, axial here green. With sort of central predictions, there's only a 10% chance that you'd see the axion.
That's right, yes.
And that a single black hole spin measurement in the wrong mass range could conceivably say that these searches are not worth doing?
A single wrong black hole measurement?
Like if there's a single black hole measurement, that could extend the blue region down.
Yes, well, okay, so... The 10% comment the 10% comment is correct as it stands, but it also scales, it also could be improved. So advanced LIGO increases their sensitivity by a factor of 10, then the central expectation would go to 1. For the spin limits, it's if you have a wrong measurement or you have a new measurement that excludes it, then you know it's not there, but then you know it's not there. So it could be anywhere, right? Yeah, exactly. And it's still, I'm not saying...
This detection mechanism you don't learn anything.
If you don't see anything, then at this point with these sensitivities, then yes, you can't exclude it yet. You can only exclude with something like the spin measurements, or if the sensitivity of the detector increases by maybe a factor of 30 or 100 when you start being sensitive to a huge volume of black holes and then you get more events.
And then I was also wondering about if you could remind us the lower boundary of the green region.
The lower boundary of the green region, yes. That's
set
by
black holes or by black hole?
No, that's set by black hole masses. Yes.
Okay.
So in principle, I mean, this is a bit qualitative, but in principle, it could go down.
But that's roughly like the four solar masses.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
So it's actually really hard to get below that.
Well, apparently, if you have.
Totally
yes, if you have two, well, if you have, say, two neutron stars that are around one solar mass each, which is typical, and they merge, then they'll make a black hole that's roughly two solar masses. So maybe those processes are more rare than the ones that from stellar collapse, but they could still be there. Yeah.
And anyway, that's only going to buy you like
a factor of two. Yes. You're not going to do much better than a factor of two.
No, but you will also see the following. I was talking to Lisa about this, and he pointed out the following interesting fact. So let's say you observe a neutron star merger or a black hole neutron star merger. So that happens very quickly, right? So you see the frequency drift, you see the waveform, you see some non-coherent wave drifting across your sensitivity plane. And then after, let's say, a year or so after that merger happens, you get some monochromatic signal because you have transitions happening and then aggregations happen. So you could have time-correlated measurements with when a merger happens, with when the signal appears. Once you know you've identified some source, some merger of low mass.
That's cool.
allows us to dream.
Also, there's a comment on the blue region. For the same reason, then you can extend the green region down because of the minimal black hole size. The blue region doesn't really shift down very much. Because the blue region, because you measure black holes on such a mass, so that they don't go down in mass, so they can't really extend the blue region.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Okay, so is the blue region already set by like the fairly small black holes?
Yeah,
yeah.
Not that big.
The range is between like the currently measured spin one wise ones are between 6 and 15 solar masses, so you can't go. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. If that's the most pessimistic things you can say, then I'm happy.
Thank you.